From NPR News, you're listening to the podcast edition of Weekends on All Things Considered, the best picks from our programs on Saturday and Sunday. I'm Don Gagne. Americans and Their Cars, a romance for the ages? Maybe not.
This is a whole generation that's grown up possibly not having a license, certainly not owning cars in the way people their age did before.
Also this weekend, how secure is encrypted email? We'll find out. And baby names, a legal fight in Tennessee over an infant named Messiah.
Baby names in this country pass muster all the time with the courts. Names from Toilet Queen to Tiny Hooker.
You dreamed about it as a kid and were resigned to the fact it would never happen. But it may soon be here.
What is really fantastic is taking something out of the comic books and actually using it in a practical world.
The personal jetpack. Sorry, it won't be cheap. Also, we'll hear how the Cup Song became a phenomenon. And a new book gives a close-up view of the outlaw Jesse James. We'll talk to singer Irene Diaz about her studio debut, I Love You Madly, it's called. Plus, music paying tribute to two guys named Merle and Buck.
Together again.
Vince Gill is joined by pedal steel master Paul Franklin on a trip through the sound of Bakersfield. That's all on this episode of Weekends on All Things Considered.
The long, lonely nights.
You women have heard of jalopies, you've heard the noise they make, but let me introduce my new Rocket 88.
This tune from 1951, Rocket 88, is often called the very first rock and roll song. And no wonder, it's about a car. Almost as soon as they started rolling off the assembly lines, automobiles became synonymous with freedom. And in the post-World War II boom, our relationship with cars intensified. It was about horsepower and status, being American, and for young people, rebellion. For generations, cars inspired countless songs, books, movies. But now, there are signs that our car culture is losing some of its shine. And that's our cover story today. Is America's love affair with the automobile over? The film American Graffiti just turned 40 years old. It celebrated the deep relationship between American teen culture and the automobile back in the early 1960s.
Hey, you're supposed to be the fast thing in the valley, man, but that can't be your car. It must be your mama's car. I'm sort of embarrassed to be this close to you.
A lot has changed since those days. Studies show that teenagers are driving less, getting their licenses later, and waiting longer to purchase their first new car. NPR's Sonari Glinton hit the streets to find out why.
When you're a teenager, there are so many things you desperately want to find. You want to find friends, fun, a future, freedom. Well, how do you get those things? In American Graffiti, it seems so much simpler. The kids find all of that just by getting in their cars. American Graffiti is set in Modesto, California. It was filmed elsewhere. In the film, the teenagers spend a whole lot of time tooling around in their cars, looking, cruising. I wanted to see if any part of the city was like the movie, so on a couple of hot summer weekend nights, I drove around Modesto. With its downtown and its long, wide streets, the city seems a perfect place to cruise. But that's not what was happening. Celine Murillo and her friends were among the many teens I saw dropped off at the movie theater. Celine is 19 and she doesn't have a driver's license.
You know, if there was something that was actually forcing me to get out there and, like, actually get my license, then I probably would. There's, like, you know, your parents, so you have something to depend on, and so maybe that's why.
Celine says her parents don't mind dropping her off around town, and she doesn't mind either. Blanca Correa is 16, and she doesn't have a driver's license and no immediate plans to get one.
I've never actually thought it was that important.
In Modesto?
Yeah.
If you and your friends want to get around, how do you and your friends meet up with each other?
Well, they pick us up and we leave.
So Blanca says she can get around asking friends for rides, and if it's important, her parents will give her a lift. Neither see a license in and of itself as a symbol of independence. They're not alone. Buying a car, even a used one, is tough for teens who aren't financially independent. But getting a driver's license, that's different. That's a sign of intent. 20 years ago, 3/4 of kids would have had their license by the age 18, according to AAA. Only about half do now. But what do young people with more financial independence, say in their early 20s, feel about driving?
Well, I better always have a car, because how else would you get places? I better have a car.
That's Megan Kurtz. She's the only one of her group that owns a car. I found Kurtz, Mackenzie Yates, Katie Gills, and my club at an In-N-Out Burger. Club says he wishes he could afford a car.
My girlfriend drives me everywhere. That sounds sad, and like 20 years ago I'd be considered pathetic, but it's almost normal now to be that way.
Club says for many of his friends, the web and social media can take the place of a car.
You can visually communicate with each other like that, like in the snap of a finger, other than, you know, spending $10 in gas that you don't have and then seeing the same exact thing.
Katie Gill says cruising, just to cruise, even in Modesto, is a thing of the past. She says just driving around your town has given way to documenting your life on Facebook or Twitter or Instagram. Gill says young people in Modesto definitely drive, but it's with a different purpose.
They're not likely to just aimlessly go.
It has to be Instagram worthy.
Yes.
It has to be worth their popularity.
Like, they have to cross an event off their list. You know what I mean?
It has to be Instagram worthy.
Yeah, it has to be pretty, or somebody has to look and be like, oh man, I wish I could have done that.
Yeah.
And if nobody sees, like, it's not really worth the time to go and share it with the world.
In modern day Modesto, cars are vitally important, but not in the same way they were in American Graffiti. They don't represent freedom, individuality, a rite of passage, a way to meet up with friends. Sonari Glinton, NPR News.
Okay, so let's talk about this. Micheline Maynard is a veteran journalist. A lot of that time spent covering automobiles and transportation. She now oversees a research project called Curbing Cars, Rethinking the Way We Get Around. Mickey, you just listened to Sonari Glinton's report there. Can you confirm for us that what he was talking about there from Modesto, California, is a trend throughout the country? Are young people less interested in getting their driver's licenses and owning cars?
Yes, they are. Those kids that Sonari Glinton talked to are the microcosm of what's going on among teen drivers. It's something like 28% of teenagers who have their driver's licenses at 16, which is down 20 or 30% from a quarter century ago. And even by the time they graduate, you still have a big portion of teenagers who haven't taken driver's ed and don't have a license.
Why not?
A couple of reasons. The most often reason cited in a new University of Michigan study is that they just don't have the time. Many states have now changed teen driving laws, so you have to spend a certain amount of time in the car with a parent. There are limits on when you can drive, and people just shrug and say, you know what, I don't need to get a license right now, I'm not going to bother. Another reason is that cars are very expensive. The average car now costs over $31,000, and that's before you factor in insurance, which is very high for teens, even if they're on their parents' insurance. It means their parents have to pay more for them to be on their insurance. Gas costs $4 a gallon in a lot of places. And then I think the third factor that teens cite is the fact that someone can drive them around, like the young man whose girlfriend in Modesto is driving him around. So they can get rides from friends and rides from parents, and they don't see a need to own a car of their own or get a license even.
So all of this sounds like very bad news for the auto industry, still a big, important industry in the U.S. Are the big automakers worried about it?
The automakers are perplexed about how to appeal to potential drivers who are between, say, about 16 and 22, and then to the millennials who are in their 20s, and even the Generation Y, which is in their 30s. Some of the messaging that's going on is targeted in shows like American Idol, where Ford has been a sponsor for years, and they've tried to show driving as fun, as something you can do with your friends. Another tactic is to realize that younger people are interested in technology, and so put a lot of technology into their cars, make them just as comfortable with the technology in automobiles as they are with their mobile devices.
So reconcile these things for me. You say driving is indeed down, but I live in Washington, D.C., and yes, we've got mass transit, and yes, we've got bike paths, but the roads are plenty clogged. And in rural areas, people absolutely need their cars.
Right. So what we talk about at Curbing Cars is something that is referred to as driving light. You probably will still own a car, but you also use an alternative to your car when you can. You try out a bike sharing program. You walk somewhere. You take public transportation. And public transit is seeing record demand at this point in time. You might try an hourly rental car. You might try ride sharing, which is something that apps on mobile phones have made possible in the last couple of years. So I think people are looking at transportation now not as just I get in the door of my car, start it, and drive away. It's I'll use my car when I need it, but if there are other cheaper, faster ways to get somewhere, I'll use that as well.
So can we get sentimental here for a minute? We both grew up in the Detroit area at a time when people adored their cars, right? It was part of who we are. Were you a Chevy family? Were you a Ford family, right? Rocket 88, the first ever rock and roll song, was about a car. Bruce Springsteen writing about Thunder Road and movies and books. Is our love affair over with the automobile? Are they just transportation?
I think the automobile has shifted from a subject of adoration for most of the public to something that's adored by a portion of the public. And other people are moving on to other interests and putting the car in a different place and, you know, than it has been in America for the past 100 years. Even if you couldn't afford to buy one of the first automobiles, you were fascinated by them. But what we're seeing now is a move from the car out of some people's hearts and basically into their garages, maybe where they should have been all along.
Mickey Maynard, thank you.
Thank you, Don.
Micheline Maynard is the editor of the website, curbingcars.com. This all gets me thinking of the cars I've owned, the full list, in order. A Maverick, an Impala, a Chevette, a Subaru, a Volvo, a Camry, a Chevy, minivan, and a Malibu. And it occurs to me that these were all more practical choices than anything else, not a lot of sex appeal or romance in that mix. But that's not to say I didn't get attached to a few of them. And at some point, in every one of these cars, there was a moment when I rolled down the windows and cranked up the tunes. Hey, what else can we do now except roll down the window and let the wind blow back your hair? Well, the night's busted open, these two lanes will take us anywhere. To the days of the Wild West and its most famous outlaw folk hero, Jesse James.
Jesse James was a lad. He killed many a man. He robbed the Glendale train. He took from the rich and he gave to the poor. He'd a hand and a heart and a brain.
Tales of his exploits have grown to almost mythological proportions since the actual man and his gang galloped over the plains, stealing horses, holding up trains, and robbing banks in the years after the Civil War. In September of 1876, Jesse, his brother Frank, and six other members of the James Younger Gang hit the First National Bank of Northfield, Minnesota. That raid and the resulting manhunt are the subject of Mark Lee Gardner's new book, Shot All to Hell, Jesse James, the Northfield Raid, and the Wild West's Greatest Escape. Mark Lee Gardner, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Don.
So Jesse James and his brother Frank, most people know that they were outlaws, but in the book, you detail the backstory of a life which led them to crime.
Yeah, I think what makes Jesse and Frank James is the Civil War. It changed them permanently, and I'm referring largely to the violence and the hatred. Jesse starts fighting as a guerrilla warrior at the age of 16.
And we're talking about the Civil War, but we're talking about Missouri in
yes.
the Civil War, which is a very, very unique case, right?
It is very unique. And to tell you how awful it was for them, you know, Jesse was whipped by militia soldiers who were trying to get information on Frank's whereabouts. And then after that, Jesse had to witness his stepfather being strung up and tortured, suffocated, trying to get information from the family. And those experiences can warp a person, and it certainly did with the James brothers.
So the other brothers in the gang with Frank and Jesse James are the Youngers, three of them. There's Cole, Jim, and Bob. Tell us about them.
Yeah, they have also some horrible experiences that propel them into this bitter life of crime after the war. Their father is murdered by federal militia. He was a very prominent businessman in Jackson County, Missouri. Cole joins the Bushwhackers, and once he joins the Bushwhackers, the federal militia hone in on his family. When they learn that his mother is helping to feed some of the Bushwhackers, the federal militia make a visit, and they force his mother to set fire to the house by her own hand. She has to burn her own house down.
And just briefly, there are three other members of the original gang, members who aren't brothers?
Yes, there's Charlie Pitts, whose real name was Samuel Wells, and he had grown up family friends with the Youngers. Clell Miller, who was a friend of Jesse and Frank's. And then a fairly new recruit named Bill Chadwell, who was from Illinois but had relocated to eastern Kansas and western Missouri.
So the Civil War ends. They're in Missouri. How does that lead to a life of crime?
They were disenfranchised because of what was called this ironclad oath, which meant basically you couldn't vote if you had supported the South, or even if your leanings were Southern, that would prevent you from voting or taking political office. So in a way, they were outcast right after the war, and some young men found a way to fight back, and their way of fighting back was taking money from these Republicans who had control, and they became numb to violence, and they looked on bank tellers and cashiers as the enemy, just like they looked on soldiers wearing blue jackets as the enemy.
Okay, so the book focuses on the Northfield Raid, the bank in Northfield, Minnesota, but you start on a dark Missouri night near a place called Rocky Cut, where the James Younger gang has stopped to train. I'd like you to read a passage.
Two robbers clambered up into the locomotive's cab and pointed their revolvers at the engineer and fireman. "Better keep quiet, you know," they said. At the back of the train, the other men threw ties and anything else handy on the rails to stop the engineer from trying to back away. At the sound of the first gunshots, John B. Bushnell, the 27-year-old express messenger who had the key to one of the safes, headed to the rear of the train. As Bushnell rushed down the aisle, a passenger asked him what was the matter. Without stopping, a visibly distressed Bushnell blurted out, "The train is being robbed. That's what's the matter."
It was on a Saturday night, and the moon was shining bright. They robbed the Glendale train. With the agent on his knees, he delivered up the keys to those outlaws, Frank and Jesse James.
So why start the book with this particular train robbery?
Well, this particular robbery leads to their adventure to Minnesota in that after this robbery is committed and they get away with $15,000, it's a very successful haul, one of their new recruits, a man named Hobbs Carey, he's spending his money loose and free, and when he gets caught, he spills everything he knows about who the robbers were, where their haunts are, and it gets pretty hot in Missouri for a while, and so they need to pick a place they can go where they're not expected.
So they scout a bunch of banks in a bunch of cities. They settle on Northfield, and everything falls apart there. This section of the book reads like it's one of those like Ocean's 11 style heist thrillers, the way they case the joint and all that. I'd like you to read another excerpt.
Now, do you want me to use the foul language of the robbers? Or?
Yeah, we'll bleep it. Have you ever been bleeped on the radio?
No, I haven't. I love it, yeah.
Okay, go ahead.
Alonzo Bunker, the First National Bank's teller, was at work at his desk when he heard the door open and footsteps on the wood floor of the small lobby. The sound was nothing new and only meant a customer had arrived. So Bunker turned from his desk and, like always, moved to the open space at the counter. But this time, three large revolvers pointed at his face. "Throw up your hands, for we intend to rob this bank," Frank James shouted. "And if you holler, we will blow your brains out."
So we're in the bank with these guys. As the gang comes in, how do you get a detail like that last part there?
You know, this was the most famous bank robbery of the 19th century, and there was a lot of interest to hear these stories over and over again. So I was fortunate in that there are many eyewitness accounts, including men who were right inside the bank with the outlaws.
The one bank employee to be killed in the raid was Joseph Lee Haywood. He was also the treasurer of one of the town's colleges, Carleton College. In fact, the college's funds were in the bank?
Yes, they were, and that's one of the keys to this bungled failure on the part of the James Younger gang, was this resistance and bravery on the part of Haywood, who knew that all the funds of Carleton College were in that safe. It could have been a disaster. It would have been a disaster.
After all of this goes down in Northfield, the men are on the run. The authorities have launched what is the largest manhunt in U.S. history at the time?
Yes, in fact, at one point, there are over 1,000 men looking for remnants of the James Younger gang. I often say it was not only the largest manhunt in U.S. history at that time, but it was also the largest gathering of inept manhunters up to that time. The feeling was they would be very easy to capture them. I mean, everybody thought that it would just be a matter of a time before these men are corralled or caught or killed. But that wasn't the case. It actually stretched out to 2 weeks before any portion of the gang was captured.
Why do we still care about these guys? I mean, it's a great tale of a long-gone America. But beyond that, what's the ongoing attraction in your view?
Well, I think part of it is that myth. And Jesse, the myth has evolved into he was a Robin Hood. You know, he stole from the rich and gave to the poor, which wasn't true. I mean, they gave to themselves and they spent the money as fast as they got it. There was no other outlaw gang as successful or long-lived as the James Younger gang. I mean, they were the quintessential horseback outlaws.
That's Mark Lee Gardner. His book is Shot All to Hell, Jesse James, The Northfield Raid, and The Wild West Greatest Escape. Mark, thanks.
Thank you, Don.
Does that sound familiar? You may recognize Cups as a rhythmic game from your childhood, or from the song Cups, which is on Billboard's Hot 100 as the number 6 song in the country right now. That's Anna Kendrick in a version of the song from the movie Pitch Perfect, which came out last year. Since then, it's blown up. Why is it so popular all of a sudden?
The original version of the song was actually called Will You Miss Me When I'm Gone, and it is a 1928 recording by the original Carter family, the very first generation.
That's Amanda Dobbins. She's written about the Cups phenomenon.
Will you miss me?
Pretty soon after that, a group called J.E. Maynard's Mountaineers, you're hearing them now, reworked the song. But where does the mashup of When I'm Gone, now known as the Cups song, and the old Cups game come in? In 2009, a British band named Lulu and the Lampshades made this video combining the two. And from there, it didn't take long. A woman named Anna Burden saw that video and made her own.
And it was this version that became instantly viral.
Anna Kendrick saw that video, learned it, and it became part of the movie. And this year, the longer, radio-friendly version of the song that you're probably most familiar with was released.
I got my ticket for the long way round, the one with the prettiest of views.
I first heard this at a wedding back home this summer. And, of course, kids and adults have been practicing the game nonstop.
Okay, from where? From five?
Five.
Okay. Up. Hit. Down.
And I'm clearly still perfecting the routine.
ticket for the long way round. Two bottle whiskey for the way. And I sure would like some sweet company. And I'm leaving tomorrow. What do you say? When I'm
perhaps you're listening to the show on a computer or on some kind of a mobile gadget while you check your email. Well, then you probably know that everything we do online leaves a digital trail. That includes all of our communication, sending an email, a message on Facebook, or online chatting. A few tech companies have been working to obscure that trail a little bit with a process known as encryption. But that got us wondering, what exactly is encrypted email?
That is a pretty big question.
That's Micah Lee, a staff technologist at the Electronic Frontier Foundation, and he helped walk us through how encryption works. He says most of us use some kind of online encryption every day without even knowing it. Sometimes you might notice a small padlock symbol on your internet browser.
You know, let's say you're paying a bill at a coffee shop or on some other open wireless network. It means that other people on that same network won't be able to spy on you.
That kind of encryption happens all the time and pretty much automatically. But what if you want to keep your information private, not just from outsiders, but from the services you use?
Let's say you are sending a private message to somebody. Maybe you don't want Facebook, for example, to know the contents of this private message.
In that case, you need to encrypt those messages yourself. To do so, you'll need software that will jumble the text, making it look like gibberish.
The actual encrypted data looks like random data.
So the person who receives your message needs to be able to unjumble it back into words. They need to decrypt it.
You actually have to send encrypted emails with other people who are also using encrypted email.
Then you're both on the same page.
Hello, my name is Don.
Hello, Don. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks. So, Micah Lee says those communications are very difficult to decode for an outsider, even for a government. But it just takes a long time and a fair amount of expertise for people to set that whole thing up.
And then also there's a million things that could go wrong.
For example, someone could just hack directly into your computer and monitor every single key you hit. If all this sounds overwhelming, Micah Lee says you're not alone. Most people don't take any additional steps to keep their info private.
The problem, I think, is that it's just very hard. So it's just the very dedicated nerds that are using it right now.
But he says he hopes some of those dedicated nerds will one day make all of that encryption automatic for all of us. Until then, send email like the whole world is watching. That is the sound of a jetpack ascending into the sky. And it's not from a movie, it's video from a test flight for a product that could be yours in a couple of years. Inventor Glenn Martin began designing a jetpack in his garage back in 1984. Last week, the Martin Aircraft Company got permission to conduct piloted tests of the one-person flying machine. So is this a science fiction fantasy about to come true? Peter Coker is CEO of Martin Aircraft Company. He's with us from his office in Christchurch, New Zealand. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
So when most people imagine a jetpack, they imagine those things that we saw a video of, you know, what, 30, 40, 50 years ago. That little thing that they wear on their back with two little handles in front and smoke shooting out of the bottom. What you have come up with is a bit more complicated. Describe for us what it looks like.
The ones you've seen in the previously that you talked about in history tend to have a very limited time of endurance, anything from, you know, 20 seconds to about 40 seconds. We wanted something they could actually use on a day-to-day basis. So what we have is we have a basic structure with the two ducts on it and the engine. And on that, we place what we call the pilot console. Primarily, it's there so that he can just stand on this thing, strap himself in, and use the controls that we have to fly himself around.
Okay, so the video, I will admit the video is very intriguing.
Looking good, ready to go.
We see the pilot take off, and there's a helicopter next to him, and he achieves significant altitude. But tell me what I'm looking at in that video.
There was a perception amongst the public in certain aviators, a skeptical perception, that actually this thing doesn't get above what we call ground effect, i.e. a couple of feet. So we wanted to do two things. We wanted to prove that. And the second thing we wanted to prove was a ballistic parachute was going to be suitable for an occasion where we had an emergency landing. What you're seeing on that particular video was actually a dummy in that particular one, because clearly we didn't want to go and try this parachute for the first time with a real person in it. And it actually went up to 5,000 feet for this particular exercise before we fired the chute.
That's a mile, just shy of a mile.
That's right. We reckon it can probably move about 8,000 feet, and we don't think that many people want to go around much more higher than that, particularly when they're strapped into this machine.
So who do you imagine is going to be buying these things, using these things?
Our first jetpack, which comes out in 2014, will be really targeted towards what we call the first responder. We have a lot of interest from the fire services around the world right now. We see it being used in search and rescue, border patrol, things like pipeline inspections, inspection of your bridges and things like that. So those are our first target areas. And there has been tremendous interest from the military across the world as well. This thing can actually be flown either as a manned item or an unmanned item.
You're describing these very practical uses, but at the same time, it feels like it's out of Marvel Comics or something.
That's the exciting part of this. I mean, I think we're finding tremendous interest in this product because of that particular concept. But what is really fantastic is taking something out of the comic books and actually using it in a practical world. I mean, this will change the whole dynamics of aviation.
Okay, so here's the big question. How much is it going to cost me to fly one of these babies off the lot?
The figures I give are, I guess, are really ballpark at this stage. For the individual in the commercial sector, we're going to be targeting around about the $150,000 to $175,000 US, about the same as a really, really good sports car.
All right. Peter Coker is the CEO of Martin Aircraft Company. You can see a video of the Martin jetpack test flights at our website. Go to npr.org and click on All Things Considered. Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much.
Republican leaders gathered in Boston for their summer meeting this week. There was a lot to talk about, from immigration and the economy to privacy and the surveillance policies of the National Security Agency. But for the GOP to shape the agenda on these issues, it needs to win national elections. And that's something it hasn't been able to do in almost a decade now. Much of the problem is changing demographics. Republican voters are overwhelmingly white as the country becomes ever more diverse. Here's the dilemma.
As much as I love and I do love to watch Fox News, we cannot win only on the basis of appealing to Fox News voters.
That's former White House Press Secretary Ari Fleischer. He knows a thing or two about winning elections with his former boss, President George W. Bush. We'll hear more from him a bit later. One faction within the party thinks it has some answers that will help expand the GOP base, the Libertarians. That's our cover story today. In a divided Republican Party, is this the Libertarians' moment? One of those Libertarians is 33-year-old Republican Congressman Justin Amash.
Whether Republicans choose to or not, the party is going to change, and Libertarian Republicans are going to be a large part of the party.
The Republican Party held on to control of the U.S. House of Representatives in 2012, but Mitt Romney was routed by President Obama, and the Senate stayed firmly in Democratic hands, worried that the GOP had lost touch with the changing demographics of the electorate. The Republican Party did some soul searching. It created something called the Growth and Opportunity Project, which came back with a 100-page report about what needs to change. But the prescription is not new policies, but messaging and how to reach out to and talk to potential voters. Ari Fleischer was on the committee that wrote the report.
Here's the challenge for Republicans. Republicans have to realize that we're no longer winning states that we used to win, not very far long ago. And those states include battlegrounds, Michigan, Pennsylvania, states that will never win the presidency again if we write off those states. Republicans have to maintain a conservative ideology and extend it graciously and welcomingly across the middle of the country as well. That's how you form a growing coalition. That's how you don't become a permanent minority party that's blocked and locked out of the White House. We are not going to win a majority of minority voters, but we can make inroads, and those inroads are vital to being a growing, successful party.
But making that happen has not been a particularly smooth process.
Anytime a party is out of the White House, you're going to see a fight for the soul of that party until a nominee emerges. I think that was true with the Democrats, if you remember, in 2007 and 2008, you had a little bit of a fight between Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama. The party couldn't have been more split. It's Republicans' turn now to be out of the White House and fight for who the nominee is that will represent the party.
The current tension within the GOP took a public and nasty turn recently when New Jersey Governor Chris Christie had strong criticism of libertarians questioning their views on national security. Christie spoke at the Aspen Institute.
This strain of libertarianism that's going through both parties right now and making big headlines, I think, is a very dangerous thought.
Hearing that, Senator Rand Paul from Kentucky, the Libertarians' highest profile leader, fired back during an appearance on Fox News.
He's making a big mistake picking a fight with other Republicans because the Republican Party's shrinking in New England and in the northeast part of our country. I'm the one trying to grow the party by talking about libertarian ideas of privacy and the internet, and attacking me isn't helping the party. He's hurting the party.
The dispute raises questions about whether the GOP is settling into protracted factional warfare. Reince Priebus is the chairman of the Republican National Committee. Speaking in Boston this week, he says it's all part of a healthy process.
We should be roiling with new ideas, new leaders, and yes, some internal debates. Thank goodness we are. And I say bring on the conversations because they're a sign that this Republican Party is preparing itself to lead this country. Are you with me?
Congressman Justin Amash of Grand Rapids, Michigan, is part of that debate.
Members of Congress who are on the more libertarian side, and it's a pretty large group now, are tired of the wars that go on overseas, think that we shouldn't be in Afghanistan, want us to bring our troops home from across the globe. And young people really represent that strain of thought. They've seen these wars go on for years with no end, and they'd like to see some peace. They'd like to see us return to some normalcy.
There's been a lot of discussion about the rise of the libertarian wing of the Republican Party. What makes you a libertarian?
Well, it's a belief in following the Constitution, in limited government, economic freedom, and individual liberty. Those are things that Republicans for many years would have said they believed in. And in fact, many Republicans, even those who don't necessarily show it in their votes, will still say they believe in those things. Unfortunately, those of us who have been more consistent in following that line of thinking have had to come up with another term or follow another term to show that we're distinct from those who have been doing the wrong thing, and that's been the term libertarianism.
The leaks by Edward Snowden and the revelations about the NSA data collection involving email traffic and other communications, has that issue being so in the news the way it has been provided libertarians with a big real-life example to hang your arguments on?
Yes. I think it's really brought home many of the things that we've been talking about. There's a real concern about a surveillance state that's been growing. There's a concern that government is collecting much more information than it actually needs to prosecute terrorism. Of course, we want the government to go after terrorists, but whatever we do has to comport with the Constitution. So we can't violate individual liberty. We can't violate privacy and property rights in the pursuit of terrorism.
The Libertarian Caucus is certainly growing, but there are other factions within the Republican Party that are larger than yours. Evangelicals, for one. And we do see a lot of conflict, especially between the libertarians and the evangelicals. Is that a problem for the party?
I don't think so. The Republican Party is going to be a coalition of people. We're not going to agree on everything. But at the end of the day, look, I live in a district that is socially conservative. I'm personally very socially conservative. But the fact that I don't think the federal government should be involved in determining what a marriage is not anti-socially conservative. It's both libertarian and socially conservative, because social conservatives also believe the government shouldn't be entangled in these things. So I think there's a lot of common ground, and we have to work together.
You say there's always been that coalition, and certainly for decades that coalition held together, and it was a winning formula for Republicans. But with President Obama's last two victories, both easy victories, that coalition seemed very frayed.
Yeah, it's gotten weaker because there's been not tremendous acceptance initially by more establishment Republicans of the libertarian part of the party. And I think more and more are starting to understand that you need people like Rand Paul and Ted Cruz and Justin Amash to be a part of this party if you want it to grow, and that we're all going to need to work together.
There is a great deal at stake for the GOP. Watching all of this very closely is David Cohen, a political science professor at the University of Akron in Ohio.
Republicans are without a doubt looking for a new formula for 2016. Libertarianism is something that a lot of Republicans are turning to, especially because it is popular with the younger crowd. And that is a demographic that they desperately need to do better with. That socially liberal, economically conservative, non-interventionist policy stance popular among libertarians is very appealing to younger college-age people. You know, and some of these people are disaffected Obama voters who have been turned off by the Obama administration's national security policies and foreign policies and interventionism.
The last two presidential elections featured a very prominent libertarian candidate on the Republican side, Congressman Ron Paul, since retired from Congress. He didn't do very well. What does that tell us?
Well, it tells us that libertarianism has not become part of the mainstream of the Republican Party yet, and that his timing wasn't that great. But certainly it looks like his son is ready to capitalize on his father's popularity.
Of course, that's Rand Paul, the senator from Kentucky.
Yes, and he's very much making a name for himself. He won a lot of fans over with his filibuster earlier in the year over the Obama administration's drone policy and filibustering Obama's CIA choice. And that was a case of not only libertarians and many Republicans appreciating what he did, but also some liberals as well.
He's got a bigger megaphone because he's a U.S. senator, not a member of the House, so that helps. But he also benefits from his father's history, right?
He absolutely does. I mean, he's already got the name recognition built in. Many view him as, at least in the Republican Party, as less radical than his father. Of course, he did get into a big dispute earlier with Governor Chris Christie, which I think really highlights that there is a split in the Republican Party, especially on foreign policy and national security issues.
Is that one of those moments, the Rand Paul, Chris Christie dust-up, that is maybe good for libertarians but bad for the party?
It's unclear whether it's bad for the party or not. Clearly, there's a real split in the Republican Party. There's a lot of fatigue among Republicans after two major wars, Iraq and Afghanistan, winding down. Some Republicans view, in hindsight, those wars as being a mistake. And there really is a non-interventionist to an isolationist bent among some of these libertarians. And within the Republican Party, you still have a number of people who believe in interventionist foreign policy, but that battle is going to continue to play out over the next couple of years.
The Republican Party has always had its factions, but for the longest time, they formed a very strong coalition. But these days, they seem to be fighting with one another more than they are working together to form some sort of a solid three-legged stool.
There is no question that there is a civil war that is waging within the party. And let's not forget about the Tea Party advocates as well. And there's a lot of common ground among these various wings, but there's also some significant areas of disagreement, especially on social issues when we're talking about libertarians and social or religious conservatives. Libertarians are very much more in line with progressives and liberals on those social issues. There are a lot of social conservatives that have a real problem with libertarian stances on social issues such as same-sex marriage, LGBT issues, immigration, etc. And those are going to be some of the more significant fights that you're going to see in the upcoming months.
Professor Cohen says fights between Republicans on specific issues will likely continue over the coming months and years. And while this is a new moment of prominence for the libertarian point of view within the GOP, it remains to be seen if it is just a moment or something more lasting. It's not unusual to hear about celebrities choosing outlandish names for their children. Jay-Z and Beyoncé's Blue Ivy, Gwyneth Paltrow's daughter, Apple, magician Penn Jillette's daughter, Moxie Crimefighter. But they're not the only ones who do it. Last week, a Tennessee judge decided to change one of these unusual names for a 7-month-old boy called Messiah. In a recent piece, Slate senior editor Dahlia Lithwick tackled the legal ins and outs of parental naming rights. She joins us from member station WVTF in Charlottesville, Virginia. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, baby Messiah's parents went to court over a child support issue. And along the way, the judge somehow decides that this baby's name needs to be changed. I think I need some explanation.
They're fighting over many things, but one of the things they're fighting about is the last name. The judge jumps in and says, you know, I'm going to change last name, but hey, I'm also changing his first name because Messiah is not an appropriate first name. And then she goes on to explain, quote, the word Messiah is a title, and it's a title that has only been earned by one person, and that one person is Jesus Christ, end quote. So she changes his first name to Martin.
Last year, there were over 700 babies born in the U.S. who were given the name Messiah. We know that because the Social Security Administration keeps track of such things. So the name is neither unusual nor unprecedented.
It's true, and it's in fact on the rise. It's also worth flagging that almost 4,000 babies last year were named some version of Jesus or Jesus.
So this story took you down the rabbit hole of unusual names for kids. Tell us about little Adolf Hitler Campbell of New Jersey.
Adolf Hitler Campbell's father is a neo-Nazi. His daughter was called Jocelyn Aryan Nation Campbell. And he got into trouble in 2008 because he wanted a birthday cake for young Adolf Hitler to be frosted, and the bakery refused to do it. And there was a lot of attention around that.
And the red flag was raised by the bakery, not by some state official looking at a birth certificate early on.
Precisely. The bakery just said, you can name your kid whatever you want. I'm not writing happy birthday Adolf Hitler on the cake. There is absolutely nothing under New Jersey law that precludes you from naming your child Adolf Hitler.
What kind of restrictions are in place around the country? What are some of the more interesting ones?
I learned that in California, believe it or not, you can't use diacritical marks. So somebody who wanted to name his daughter Lucia with an accent over the C was precluded from doing that.
Hmm.
In Massachusetts, you can't use more than 40 characters in a name. That's for purely computer-based reasons.
Mm-hmm.
New Jersey and Nebraska don't let you use obscenities, but it really differs from state to state. Most states, though, are pretty broad in the latitude that they give you.
Okay, so let's bounce around the world a little bit. Take me where you will.
Well, Germany's interesting because it, like many, many Western democracies, it has to be immediately clear your child's gender from your name. My favorite one is probably New Zealand. New Zealand kind of becomes famous at some point because a judge blocked the name Tallulah Does the Hula from Hawaii. but really, some countries go as far as to have lists. In Denmark, you have 7,000 names that are pre-approved by the government. Same in Iceland.
Okay, let's go back to baby Messiah. The ACLU has weighed in.
Yeah, the ACLU has offered to help the mother out. I also saw that an atheist group has weighed in on the mother's behalf. It will be challenged mid-September.
But there is kind of that core question, can a parent name a child something that may make that child's life difficult down the road?
Baby names in this country pass muster all the time with the courts. Names from Toilet Queen to Tiny Hooker to Acne Fountain. So we don't seem to think it's the place of the courts to intercede in those cases. And I think that makes us very, very different from other Western democracies.
Dahlia Lithwick, thanks a lot.
Thank you so much for having me.
We are about to be joined by a pair of country music legends. Vince Gill has been recording and making records since he was a teenager. He's a gifted multi-instrumentalist and singer and songwriter. His newest work is a joint project with someone you may not know, but have certainly heard if you like country music. Paul Franklin plays pedal steel guitar like few others have. We'll be right back. Their new recording is called Bakersfield. It's a tribute to a particular kind of country music that came out of Bakersfield, California, and which was created and championed by a couple of guys from that town named Buck Owens and Merle Haggard. Vince Gill, Paul Franklin, thank you for joining us.
Man, what a treat.
Thank you, yeah.
Okay, so this is one that's always kind of hard to describe for people. What is the Bakersfield sound?
So many of those musicians migrated west from the Dust Bowl looking for work and a place to scratch a living out of the dirt like they'd been doing, and they seemed to take that music with them, very honky-tonk driven, very beer joint driven, and it just was unabashed. It wasn't smooth, it wasn't croonish. You know, I think that what you have to do is compare it to what was going on with the country music that was being made primarily in Nashville, which was a lot smoother string arrangements and kind of cosmopolitan. And along comes Buck and Merle, and they get these twangy Telecasters and Ralph Mooney playing a singing steel guitar, and in a way it's like the Rolling Stones of country music.
Tonight the Bible let me down.
So let's talk about some of the classics on here. You guys knew these songs when they first came out, first go round. Buck Owens, Together Again.
Together Again. You got to put that in the top three of all time. Every now and then, you know, a song, a singer, and a record, production, all those things just fall in line, and you make the most amazing piece of music you could ever hope to make. It's simple, but it's heartfelt. It's got the greatest solo in the world. It's got Buck singing his brains out, and that for me is, that's a top five all-time greatest record ever.
The love that we knew is living again. No, nothing else matters now. We're together again.
Those guys had a knack for writing material that delivered the message with a minimal amount of words, and I think that's why everybody can sing it, and it's a thing that just, you know, touches your soul.
So this disc ends with a Merle Haggard classic, The Fight Inside of Me. When that song hit in 1969, you guys were both kids, it landed smack dab in the middle of the culture wars in the United States. Vietnam was raging. He takes shot at protesters, sings, If You Don't Love It, Leave It.
I hear people talking bad about the way we have to live here in this country.
Talk about the decision to do that one, aside from the fact that it's a Merle Haggard classic.
Well, I've always admired someone like Merle Haggard that wasn't afraid to bow up on somebody, you know, and tell the truth and stick up for people. They talked about him being the poet of the common man, and it was really true. You know, you go to somebody like Johnny Cash, who's a great defender of people that were downtrodden or weren't treated fairly or disrespected or whatever, and they just had a sense of fairness about them that was inspiring.
Baby.
I was really taken with singing the song because I didn't take it as a very bravado-ish type song of, you know, I'm going to take you to task if you don't stick up for this. And I looked at it as my life of watching and knowing, and I've done a good bit of work with the men and women of our armed services who do stick up for us and defend our freedoms, and I have a great deal of respect for them. So my response to this song was much more emotional than bravado. And I think as a 56-year-old man, I took it a lot differently than maybe I would have as a young buck. I was really taken with the emotion of the lyric of that song. It was really quite poetic.
They're walking on the fighting side of me. Running down.
I'm speaking with Vince Gill and Paul Franklin about their new album, Bakersfield. So Buck Owens, of course, has passed on. Merle Haggard still very much with us. And
very, very much.
Yes.
Yeah.
He wrote the liner notes, and he says,
he
quote,
yeah.
I like the whole album. Did you talk to him first?
Well, I mentioned to Vince, I said, wouldn't it be great if we could get Haggard, after we finished everything, to write the liner notes? So we waited for several days on pins and needles, because of all the people that would hear this record, he's the one that mattered most. You know, because if he didn't like it, it's like we're crushed, because he's our hero.
I want each of you to talk briefly about the other for a moment. Paul, let's start with you. What about Vince Gill? Is there something that you hear, you know, something that we civilians might not notice?
Oh, God. I mean, I could go on for days, but just to talk about his singing, very few singers get to his level of emotion. He can sing all the licks in the world, you know, the technique and all that, but I've never heard him. I can honestly say I've never heard him sing a note that he didn't feel with all his heart.
So, Vince, your turn. What is it about Paul Franklin's pedal steel work that just stops you cold?
It's got to be his eyes. No, I'm just kidding. You know what? Here's the great thing about Paul is, even though he's his own stylist in definitive playing, he's got enough of the history in his heart, that's the most important place, that he knows what Ralph Mooney played like. He knows what Buddy Emmons played like. He knows all these greats that were such a huge part of this history, that it gives him a vocabulary that's deeper than anybody I've ever known that's played the instrument. And it's always been my favorite instrument. You know, I even tried to learn to play the steel guitar as a young kid at 18, 19 years old, and we eventually had to sell it. We called it a mercy selling because it was killing people. I think I've always loved the instrument the most because it sounds like a voice to me.
Have you taken these songs back to Bakersfield for a live performance yet?
We get to. We're touring all the rest of this year, and we're going to play Bakersfield on October 25th, so we've both got that circled as probably a career highlight.
Yeah,
that's going to be some fun.
I know that you've been fooling around on me right from the start.
That's Vince Gill and Paul Franklin. Their new album of classic country music is called Bakersfield. Gentlemen, it has been a real pleasure. Thanks.
Thanks, buddy.
Thank you, Don.
Come on home and fool around with me.
For the week ending August 18th, 2013, that's the podcast edition of Weekends on All Things Considered, the best of our programs from Saturday and Sunday. The staff includes Catherine Fox, Liz Baker, Elliot Hannon, Sarah Ventry, Chris Connolly, Chris Keneally, Tom Dreisbach, Bill Harrell, and Becky Hersher. The technical director is Daniel Shukin. Mathani Maturi is senior editor, and Steve Lichtai is our senior producer. I'm Don Gagne, and we'll be back next week with more of the best stories and features from All Things Considered on the weekend. And remember, you can always hear the show on your local public radio station. Thanks for listening.